It is Thursday, February 4th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Sarah Williams in Washington. Coming up, Latin American health officials hold an emergency meeting on the Zika virus. Cambodian opposition leader Sam Rainsy tells VOA his country has been inspired by recent changes in Myanmar.
The two countries present many similarities. And Burma is achieving a peaceful democratic transition.
And country music fans, take note. Some of your favorite performers are getting ready to go on tour. It's all ahead. Latin American health ministers are backing a public information campaign and boosting the number of medical workers to fight the mosquito-borne Zika virus. The 14 officials held emergency talks in Montevideo, Uruguay, Wednesday. Among the participants was Brazil, which has been hit the hardest by the virus. Meanwhile, U.S. officials have confirmed the transmission of the Zika virus by sexual contact. Authorities in Dallas, Texas, say a person was infected with Zika after having sexual contact with a sick individual who had returned from a country where the virus was present. Dr. Lisa Maragakis is the Senior Director of Infection Control at Johns Hopkins Hospital in Baltimore, Maryland. I asked her to describe the causes of the recent outbreak and the added concern about sexual contact causing the virus.
Well, the cause of the Zika virus outbreak is really transmission of a virus via mosquitoes. And there are several examples of viruses that are transmitted in this way by mosquitoes. And this is very similar to other things that we've seen, like West Nile virus and dengue and other pathogens. So in that respect, the Zika virus is very similar to other things we've seen before. You're right that the recent reports of sexual transmission of the Zika virus are of concern and are somewhat different from these other pathogens that I just mentioned, because that indicates another way that the virus can be spread. There are only a very small number of reports of this so far, so I don't think we should become overly alarmed at this point, but investigation will have to be ongoing about that potential. The supposition would be that during the acute phase of infection, that there was enough virus around that it was able to be transmitted sexually in that case.
Why is this a virus? Why can this be so devastating to infants?
So the Zika virus itself is a fairly mild, self-limited illness and wasn't of great concern for that reason until this association was noticed with these terrible congenital abnormalities that have now been tentatively associated both geographically and temporally to Zika virus infection. When a pregnant woman acquires the infection, that infection in her bloodstream can be transmitted to the fetus, and it is believed that that may be the mechanism that causes neurologic abnormalities and congenital defects like we're seeing.
Now, how can people avoid this? You know, I'm thinking particularly of childbearing age women. What lengths do people have to do to, you know, if they're considering having a child, to avoid this?
Right. Well, the greatest risk, because of the congenital abnormalities, the greatest risk of this virus right now is acquiring it while you are pregnant. And so that's why the warnings really are for women who are currently pregnant or who are actively considering becoming pregnant or may be in early stages of pregnancy, to really take extreme caution. This involves being careful to avoid the possibility of exposure, if at all possible, and that involves consideration of whether you really need to travel to the areas where there's active ongoing transmission. If you are living in one of those areas or traveling to one of the areas, then it involves really avoiding mosquito bites. And mosquitoes are the vectors for many pathogens, so I think, you know, the message about avoiding mosquito bites applies to many pathogens, not just Zika. So that's things like insect repellents, trying to avoid areas that have a lot of mosquitoes, staying indoors in air conditioning when possible, wearing long sleeves or long clothing, some of which can be treated to repel mosquitoes and things like that.
Dr. Lisa Maragakis, the Senior Director of Infection Control at Johns Hopkins Hospital. In other news, Cambodian opposition leader Sam Rainsy says he hopes to return to his country soon. He's been in exile since November because he faced his arrest in Cambodia on defamation charges brought by the country's foreign minister. Cambodia is preparing for local elections next year and national elections in 2018. Prime Minister Hun Sen has been in power for more than three decades. Sam Rainsy's pro-democracy Cambodia National Rescue Party says it was denied a majority in national elections in 2013 because of vote rigging. I'm joined now by Cambodian opposition leader Sam Rainsy. At the moment, and you have left the country, how would you assess the country's political situation at the moment?
We are preparing elections. Historical election due to take place next year, and also another election the following year. And we have set up a new electoral commission, more credible, more acceptable. So the forthcoming elections will be more meaningful. What is important now is to ensure a peaceful democratic transition. And what is happening in Burma, Myanmar, is very meaningful because the two countries present many similarities. And Burma is achieving a peaceful democratic transition. And we are trying to make sure that Cambodia also will have a peaceful democratic transition.
Do you intend to return to the country anytime soon?
Yes, definitely. We think that the situation will move forward because any credible election would require the participation of the leader of the opposition. Actually, there is a new position that has been created. I am the person who first occupied that position, is the minority leader. So the minority leader has to be in Cambodia because he is the only credible challenger to the incumbent prime minister. So the next election will need the participation of both political leaders.
U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry was just recently in Cambodia. The United States, as well as some other countries, say the Philippines, you know, other countries in Asia, particularly in Southeast Asia, are concerned about China's growing influence. What role does Cambodia have to play in that, you know, between the other countries in Southeast Asia and China?
Cambodia has to be neutral. It is her interest. It is also her obligation in accordance with the 1991 Paris peace agreements on Cambodia. Cambodia has to be neutral and at the same time work for regional and world peace. So we should encourage all parties involved in any conflict to engage in serious negotiations to settle any problem peacefully.
All right. Thank you so much.
Thank you. Thank you.
Cambodian opposition leader Sam Rainsy. Now with a look at what's trending on social media is editor Andrew Palshevsky. Hello, Andrew.
Hello. Well, we have hashtag Millennial Bill of Rights that's trending, and I really like this story for a number of different reasons. First off, as you often see on social media, it starts with somebody who's obscure. In this case, it was an account that had only 1,300 followers, and they tweeted out these different hashtag games, and they tweeted out hashtag Millennial Bill of Rights, asking people what it would be on your Millennial Bill of Rights for the Millennial generation, which is roughly people who are 18 to 30 years old. And from there, it kind of went viral, and people putting all different kinds of things that they think should be on this so-called Millennial Bill of Rights. You see a lot of people raising very serious issues, saying health care for all, student loan forgiveness or better repayment terms. And then you see very funny things, people joking, saying, oh, well, millennials and their Bill of Rights should have, you know, free cell phones or free coffee or lack of responsibilities, all these things that millennials get tagged with some of the negative attributes. But one of the interesting things I found as well, and one of the other reasons I really like this story, is that it's now linked to politics in the 2016 presidential election, because one of the things that a lot of people are citing is healthcare. So you see a lot of young people using this hashtag Millennial Bill of Rights, putting things from Senator Bernie Sanders or former Secretary of State Hillary Clinton, saying they're standing for health care, they're standing for young people. So it's now gotten drawn into this broader context of this 2016 election. We also have hashtag before Facebook. Now, this was on a TV show here in the U.S. called At Midnight that is very social media savvy, and they propose these different hashtag games and things for their fans. And hashtag before Facebook, they ask their fans to weigh in and say, what was it like before Facebook? And just like hashtag Millennial Bill of Rights, you have some very serious things saying, you know, I actually had friends, I actually could interact with people. So one person said, I didn't have to, you know, I used to just be bullied in the lunchroom. Now I'm bullied 24 hours a day on social media, unfortunately. But a lot of funny things also, people saying, you know, I have to print out likes and hand them out to my friends, little thumbs up instead of just clicking a button, or I'd have to actually go, you know, see people and interact with them.
Well, thanks very much, Andrew. That's social media editor Andrew Palshevsky. This is VOA.
Here's science in a minute.
To help prepare for extended space flight to an asteroid or perhaps Mars, the European Space Agency and NASA are planning to send a group of volunteers to bed for 60 days. According to NASA, prolonged weightlessness during space travel can cause problems such as muscle shrinkage and bone loss, and the bed rest is intended to mimic conditions that can lead to these losses. Astronauts aboard the International Space Station currently exercise for 2 hours a day to maintain their muscle and bone health. Along with keeping the volunteers in bed for 60 days, researchers at the DLR German Aerospace Center in Cologne will also put them on a centrifuge to see if artificial gravity produced by the rotating machine will offset the negative effects of weightlessness. The ESA DLR researchers conducted one 60-day bed rest study last November, but it didn't include the centrifuge tests. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
This is International Edition on the Voice of America. I'm Sarah Williams. Coming up, country music stars are about to hit the road. Representatives of the 12 nations that make up the Trans-Pacific Partnership Pacific Rim Free Trade Zone signed the massive document Thursday in a ceremony in Auckland, New Zealand, hosted by Prime Minister John Key.
Signature today is an important step, but TPP is still just a piece of paper, or rather over 16,000 pieces of paper, until it actually comes into force. To make the economic opportunities of TPP a reality for our businesses and our consumers, our investors and our workers, we need to complete our respective domestic processes so we can ratify TPP and bring it into force.
In a statement Wednesday, President Obama called it a forward-looking trade deal that sets new high standards for trade and investment. He said the PAC, which covers about 40% of the world's economy, eliminates thousands of taxes, promotes a free and open internet, prevents unfair laws that restrict the free flow of data and information, and includes strong labor and environmental commitments. The participating nations now have 2 years to ratify or reject the agreement. Its future in the U.S. Congress remains uncertain. Michael Froman is the U.S. Trade Representative.
We are working with our stakeholders, we're working with members of Congress, we're working with the leadership of Congress, educating everybody as to what's in the agreement, addressing their questions and concerns. And I'm confident at the end of the day, because of the strong benefits to the U.S. economy, which have been estimated to be over $130 billion a year of GDP growth, as well as more than $350 billion of additional exports, that members of Congress will see the benefits for their constituents and will have the necessary bipartisan support to be approved.
Gary Huffpower of the Washington-based Peterson Institute for International Economics tells International Edition's Victor Beatty that President Obama's assessment of the TPP is an accurate one.
It's new high standards. It's not the best standards. In other words, we're not doing something like creating the sort of internal market we have in the United States. No, it's a long way from that. But we are reducing a lot of barriers, both to trade in goods and services. So by services, I mean things like health services, selling health services to foreign countries through the internet, or financial services like banking or mutual funds. Goods, obviously, agricultural products, manufactured products, but the barriers, the tariffs in the case of goods, do not go to zero immediately. It takes some years, maybe on average about 10 years, depending on the product. And investment, it's going to be easier for a foreign firm to invest in one of the partner countries than it was before. But it's not going to be exactly the same or as easy as investing in its own country. This is a step forward, a big step forward.
There are opponents in the U.S. who say it's going to cost American jobs.
Yes, they are wrong. I know they say that. They insist on that. Our calculations first, but the evidence from prior agreements absolutely refutes that. There is no evidence that you lose jobs on account of trade agreements, but it's also no evidence that you gain jobs on trade agreements. What happens is that the jobs move from less efficient to more efficient kinds of work in each country. Now, I know that's a hard concept to grasp, but it's really a matter of doing things more efficiently, not less jobs or more jobs.
This event, whenever it occurs, the signing or negotiations, always seem to attract protesters. Some of them argue that this will benefit big business at the expense of workers.
Well, they say that again. I mean, there's a lot of misinformation, and even at the highest levels of presidential debate. However, the evidence we have is that this agreement, like agreements in the past, will increase the income of workers in percentage terms as much as it increases corporate profits. It's not skewed in favor of corporate profits, and there are a lot of reasons for that, but the evidence just doesn't bear it out.
Gary Huffbauer of the Peterson Institute for International Economics. This is VOA.
Hello, I'm Carol Castiel, host of VOA's Encounter. Join me and two advocates from the world of politics, public policy, or academia, debating critical and controversial issues of our day, bringing depth, perspective, and insight to the world around us. That's Encounter every Saturday and Sunday on VOA.
Hi, my name's Larry London. Welcome to Border Crossings, your request and dedication program here at the Voice of America. 1500 Universal, Monday through Friday, we're there for an hour playing your favorite music. You can send an email in and request your favorite songs by your favorite artists. You can also phone in as well. We have great contests and surprise guests from time to time. Border Crossings, every single day during the week at 1500 Universal, here on the Voice of America.
There's nothing like seeing your favorite country artists perform live. With so much new music being released in 2015 and 2016, many artists are hitting the road. VOA Music's Nikki Strong is here to give us the latest on who may be headed your way soon. Nikki, I heard two of your favorite artists are headed out on tour, Chris Stapleton and Miranda Lambert.
Yes, Sarah, they both are headed out, but not together, not on the same lineup. Chris Stapleton and Hank Williams Jr. are doing a limited run where they will be co-headlining a tour that starts August 5th in Tampa, Florida, and they'll hit 8 U.S. cities throughout the month before wrapping up on August 27th in Cincinnati, Ohio. Miranda Lambert is doing her Keeper of the Flame tour with Kit Moore and Brothers Osborne opening. And that's a summer tour that kicks off in May. Also around the same time, she's going to be doing Kenny Chesney's Spread the Love tour as well with Sam Hunt and Old Dominion. Most of those dates are in the summer. So she'll be all over the place in the U.S. during the summer.
Well, will Miranda be touring abroad as well?
Yeah. In fact, she will be hitting England, Ireland, and Scotland March 11th through the 13th for the Country to Country tour. Other artists on that tour in Europe include Dwight Yoakam, Thomas Rhett, and Ashley Monroe. And she's working on new music, too. So she's busy.
Yeah. What other artists are also touring outside the U.S.?
Okay, so there are several. Let me see how many I can get to. Carrie Underwood, the Storyteller Tour, is underway now. The first 2 weeks in March, she has dates in Sweden, Norway, and the UK, and she heads to Canada in late May as well. Easton Corbin and the Swan Brothers are the opening acts for her tour, and $1 from each ticket sold will be contributed to the CATS Foundation to benefit schools and animal charities in her hometown in Oklahoma. So I think that's pretty cool. Dierks Bentley's 2016 Somewhere on a Beach Tour kicks off May 12th in New Jersey and includes 4 dates in Europe, April 21st through the 24th in Ireland, England, and Scotland. And he will be joined by Randy Houser and Cam. Garth Brooks' World Tour is on now through July. He and his wife, Trisha Yearwood, are touring the States, but will be in Ontario late March and the first couple of days in April. And they also announced that the duet CD they've been talking about doing for a while now may actually happen this year. So I'll keep my fingers crossed. Also hitting Canada in a couple of weeks, February 14th through the 19th, Brad Paisley for the winter leg of his Crushing It World Tour, and he will be taking Eric Paisley and Cam with him. And Luke Bryan with his Kill the Lights Tour with Little Big Town and Dustin Lynch hits Ontario in June.
Wow. Well, you can hear more about artists headed your way on Country Hits USA with Nikki Strong on VOA 1. You can also reach Nikki on Facebook at VOA Music and on Twitter at VOA underscore music. Thanks a lot, Nikki.
Thank you, Sarah.
Kick the dust up. They're making that money grow. Tractors, plows with flashing lights, backing up a two-lane road. They take one last lap around. That sun up high goes down. And then it's on, come on, girl, kick it on back. Z71 like a Cadillac. We go way out where there ain't nobody.
That is Luke Bryan. Well, that's our show for today. Please visit our website at voanews.com. I'm Sarah Williams. Thanks for joining us.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
There is a rising tide of religious persecution emerging worldwide, and it disproportionately threatens religious minority groups. This threat touches Christians in the Middle East, Yazidis in Iraq, Baha'is in Iran, Hindus in Pakistan and Bangladesh, Muslims in India, or Sunni Muslims in Shia areas, or vice versa. The threat, said Special Advisor for Religious Minorities in the Near East and South and Central Asia, Knox Thames, is clear and present. Terrorists and non-state actors such as ISIL, the Nusra Front, and Al-Qaeda are some of the worst persecutors of religious minorities. But individual attackers have also perpetrated acts of violence against religious minorities. And unfortunately, in far too many places, governments continue to limit the exercise of religious freedoms. Protecting and promoting the universal right to freedom of religion is central to American foreign policy. Not only is it the right thing to do, said Special Advisor Knox, it is a smart thing to do as it plays a major role in contributing to more stable, progressive, and dynamic societies. Wherever people face religious persecution, the United States is at work finding ways to help. For example, the U.S. pressures governments to enact reforms so that religious minorities are able to freely practice their faith. Militarily, through airstrikes, the U.S. is providing protection for minority religions to remain in their ancestral homeland. The U.S. continues to provide humanitarian assistance to Syrians and Iraqis, including refugees and displaced populations, and supports resettlement for those who cannot safely return home. The U.S. is encouraging countries in the Middle East to support, through education, respect for human rights and religious freedom. Governments in the region are also being urged to take steps to protect religious minorities during holy days and religious gatherings. The United States, said President Barack Obama, will continue to work with a broad coalition against those who have subjected religious minorities to unspeakable violence and persecution. all people deserve the fundamental dignity of practicing their faith free from fear, intimidation, and violence.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the